Out of the hills of Habersham, down the valleys of Hall, on the midway between the twin cities, in the tension between a healthy skepticism and a hopeful open-mindedness, somewhere between dusk and dawn. This is Coast to Coast AM. My name is Ian Punnett, and although I couldn't say this the last time we were chatting a week ago, because the details just weren't worked out yet, it appears as though it would be best for everybody if Art will continue to do Sunday nights and he will then make room for me on Saturday nights, as this will become then the permanent slot that I'll do in a week of what we hope are always terrific shows on Coast to Coast AM with George Noory and Art Bell, and then me for this part here. And can I just say that last week when I heard Art talk about this, I was reminded of something that it will always rank as like one of the coolest things I've ever had a chance to do in broadcasting. And that was be on to announce the night that Art Bell was going to return to Coast to Coast. It was a couple years ago, obviously. Art had been away for a while. There had been others that had been doing the show, including me, filling in a lot. But I had the opportunity to come on and break the news, which many people had already picked up from the internet, but still many more had not yet heard. And I wrote this big, long piece. It was like 10 minutes long. I was just kind of milking it. I just loved talking about it and then breaking the news and just, you know, taking all these phone calls from so excited people. And it was just kind of like that. It was a neat thing that I'll always feel was a rare opportunity in broadcasting to be a part of. And it might be rivaled only perhaps by hearing that it was Art that got to say my name, which I just thought was so cool that it was Art that did that. So I was very grateful, and I still am, for everybody at Coast to Coast AM and all of you who have emailed and all of you who are listening, because there's a lot to talk about tonight. Howard Bloom's coming up next hour. More on that in a minute. A couple of stories, though. Hot summer across the United States, but bizarre weather worries going on in Japan. Have you heard what it might mean? There's some new science on the power of prayer, or perhaps the lack of power of prayer. Leading Democrat Paul Begala, strategist, political pundit on television, says that Republicans are trying to kill him and his daughter, his children. And what more we know tonight about the London subway bombers. More on all of that coming up. And that last story in particular will be a perfect lead-in for Howard Bloom. More on that in just a minute when we read the stories to you. But can I tell you, this hour, we have won a golden ticket. A special guest coming up in just a few minutes on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. It's a hot, humid night in the upper Midwest. I have packed a pipe, which I'm looking forward to partaking of later on. Got a hot cup of coffee. Got my lights off here in the studio, as always, and it's a cozy night inside. Outside, it's just darn close. Just one of those nights where we're not feeling any even hint of a breeze so far. But it could be worse. Aberrant weather patterns in Japan have made for a very strange rainy season so far. The rain front came from an area over the Sea of Japan that kind of split the Japanese archipelago in half. Half of it was just completely inundated by rain. The other isn't getting a drop. And what they're saying is that this, along with some record-setting high temperatures for Tokyo, could be the precursor for another bad year of typhoons. Last year, there were 10 of them that hit Japan, And scientists expect, meteorologists are fearing, that this year will exceed those. Now, we've already seen a record number of named storms hitting in the Gulf Coast area, including a new one coming in that's heading toward Mexico. This is just the beginning of real changes in weather patterns on a worldwide scale due to global warming, said a Japanese meteorologist who works for the Business Support Center in Japan. Once it begins, the common wisdom in our field is that the frequency of irregular phenomena will increase and their scale will become increasingly greater. Now, the interesting thing about what this scientist is predicting is what could happen to Tokyo. He's especially concerned that a class 5 typhoon will hit Japan this summer. A rise in ocean temperatures caused by global warming, he said, caused all those typhoons to be generated. Just a minor change in atmospheric pressure is enough to generate them. He said, I wouldn't be surprised to see a large number of typhoons. They are also becoming more powerful. It's possible that Japan will be hit by not one, but several big ones. Now, they define that by having winds in excess of 54 meters per second. There was a big storm back in 1959 that had winds measuring 60 meters per second. And just hypothetically here, if a typhoon in that class were to strike the capital, it would be capable of flooding 41% of Tokyo's 23 central wards. This is according to a story that ran on MSN tonight. It would be capable of flooding an area 265 square kilometers. Now, the problem with that, they say, is because the urban streets of Japan are paved, the excess water would be channeled underground. The small rivers and streams are not well protected from overflowing, and there's a strong risk that the subways would become inundated in a very short time. If that happens, scientists are worrying, people might find themselves caught in flash floods and unable to flee in time, and scientists believe that might just start happening soon. In the event of a monster typhoon, the most sensible precaution would be to head for the safety of the hills at least a day before it arrives, which has scientists in Japan doing everything they can to predict the path of these typhoons. Prayers from a distant congregation will not affect a patient's recovery, according to the British medical journal Lancet, at least not from coronary artery procedures. But they do say that bedside therapies, including music and touch therapy before surgery, reduced stress and offered a slight advantage in survival. Patients were randomly chosen to receive off-site prayer, besides therapy, both treatments or none. Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and Buddhist congregations were given patients' names and prayed for them for 5 to 30 days. Survival rates did not differ among those who received prayer and those who did not, the study found. Now, the study looked at 748 patients in 9 U.S. medical centers, but I am reminded of another study that came out this week. It was a study about medical journals. If you saw that on ABC News. But they said that, like, I don't know what the 41% of the time, I think it was 41% of the time, medical studies contradict themselves within 3 months or 2 years or something. That they 41% of the time, the same study is found to be not true. And they cited many examples of that. So who knows about that one? Young liberals this week flocked to the nation's capital to hear, among other things, liberal television pundit and Democratic strategist Paul Begala accused Republicans of wanting to kill him and his children to preserve tax cuts for the rich. This, according to CNSN News. Paul was featured at the first ever Campus Progress National Student Conference, designed to provide campus liberals with the tools necessary to fight the conservative movement, it says here. Paul Begala's presence on the panel created a stir when he said that Republicans want to kill us. I was driving past the Pentagon when that plane hit on September 11th, 2001. I had friends on that plane. This is deadly serious to me, he said. Republicans want to kill me and my children if they can. But if they just kill me and not my children, they want my children to be comforted that while they didn't protect me because they cut my taxes, my children won't have to pay any money on the children they on the money that they inherit. He said more than that, of course, but I can't help but feel he's speaking in a kind of code. I don't know what that code is, but he's obviously speaking to somebody, and I'm sure you'll hear more on that on the Sunday morning shows tomorrow. Police have released a video image of the four London bombers as they set out from Luton on their bombing mission in England. Their names have been confirmed for the first time. Mohammed Sadiq Khan is 30. Hasib Hussein is 18. Shahzad Tanweer is 22. And Jermaine Lindsay is 19. One of these names is not like the other. Peter Clark, head of the anti-terrorism branch, said the investigation continues on many fronts, but they've been grateful for the contribution made by the public in response to our previous appeals. However, we still need to find out more about these four men and their movements, both on the morning of the bombings and in the days and weeks afterward. They have received thousands of witness statements and calls to the anti-terrorist hotline. We're finding out more all the time. Tony Blair said it was time to stand up to the evil ideology behind the London bombings and other attacks. He said such violence was not a response to any particular policy or injustice, but was a fanaticism that had to be confronted. The Prime Minister said that it would be a, quote, misunderstanding of a catastrophic order to think that extremists would act differently if the developed world changed its behavior. Which brings me back to Howard Bloom, coming up next hour. He's got a new book coming out and lots of thoughts about the London bombings and Islam's war against the world, including whether or not Osama bin Laden was behind the London bombings. What can we do to stop these bombings? They say that militant Muslims have said that the Quran orders that we Westerners be tortured before being put to death, and that the question now before Islam is exactly how to torture us. Well, ask Howard Bloom if that quote is for real, what he thinks it means, and what's the nuclear danger from militant Islam. And we'll ask Howard Bloom because he'll know. Because the more you know about Howard Bloom, the more you know Howard knows everything. And we will look forward to plumbing the depths of that knowledge coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll have some fun on the phones a little bit later on this hour, but I am just so honored to present a special treat. I know it is for me. I can assume it is also for many of you listening. This weekend, there's a new version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory out in the theaters, and it's doing huge box office business. But there's a classic movie that was made back in the early 70s with Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka that will always rank as one of the best children's movies ever made for adults. And I don't know about you, but I've watched it probably more as an adult than I ever did as a kid and appreciate it more, I think, every time I watch it. And so it is a great honor that we are joined this evening on Coast to Coast by the director of the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Mr. Mel Stewart. And thank you again for giving us this time. I understand you're out for an evening with the family and you're carving a few minutes for us.
Right. Thank you for inviting me on. Actually, I'm at the Hollywood Bowl.
Who's playing?
And when I told them I was going to be on this program, they put me in a special room where my family's hearing the music, but I am hearing you.
Well, who's performing tonight?
It's a Porgy and Bess program. It's an Orr Gershwin program.
Oh, how fun.
And it is quite exciting, Rhapsody in Blue, and now they're doing numbers from Porgy and Bess, which just sensational.
Well, I would, on any other night, encourage you to run out there and enjoy wonderful music under the stars, but I'm just going to be selfish and demand that you stay because...
No, anything for you. It's fine.
Well, thank you. You have a new book out, or a book that's been out for a little while, but it's getting a lot of attention. Your book, Pure Imagination, about the making of the original Willy Wonka. And you've also been in the news a bit because of the wife of Raoul Dahl, the author of the original book and also the author of the screenplay that you based your movie on, has come out and talked about this new film as being much more what Raoul Dahl would have wanted. I went to go see it. I thought a lot of it was, you know, very interesting. It's a lot of eye candy, but then again, so was the original Willy Wonka. And so I just wanted you to share, if you could, a little bit about the secret story. And I say secret because there's just so many neat things about the making of the original Willy Wonka that I just don't think most people know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the funny thing is, they don't. After 30 years, I still get letters every day asking me about this and about that. and I enjoy, it was a wonderful adventure for me. It all started because my daughter came up to me and said, "Daddy, I just read a book called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and I want you to make it into a movie." She was 10 years old, didn't quite understand it's not that easy. But I read the book, and I thought it would make a wonderful movie, and went ahead and managed to get backing from Quaker Oats, and they gave us a big $3 million as compared with the $150 for the new one. And even in those days, $3 million didn't go very far.
Well, what's so interesting about that, too, is that Quaker Oats connection, because you had been making, what, mostly, largely, like, industrial pieces or documentaries? And
well, I was making mostly documentaries for television, like Rise and Fall of the Third Reich or Making of the President. And then I did a feature, If It's Tuesday, It Must Be Belgium.
Hey, I saw that.
Oh, you saw that one too?
I saw my my parents took me to that. I was about 8 or 9 years old. I've always remembered that movie and that title because I was in Europe last year and I had that experience of being on one of those tours where you were just every day you woke up in another country.
Everybody's been through it.
And I didn't know you did that.
Yeah, and then I've done a lot of Ripley's Believe It or Not with Jack Palance, the old one.
Sure.
And back and forth doing about movies of the week and so forth, but Willy Wonka always remains my favorite.
Yeah, that's so interesting that it was Quaker Oats that gave you the money because they had been talking to you, or they've been talking to you and David Wolper, the producer, about a new candy bar coming out.
Right. When David went over to see them about a documentary, they said, "What do you got to do with chocolate?" And he said, although he hadn't read the book, but I had told him about it, he said, "Oh, we have the perfect story for you. It's a story about chocolate. You'll bring out a chocolate bar." And it was the first tie-in idea for a movie. And they went and they made a chocolate bar. Unfortunately, when it came out, Quaker Oats didn't know how to make a chocolate bar. So most of them melted on the shelves. And so the chocolate bar never came out, but the movie did. So all's well that ends well.
You know, I have to tease my sister-in-law about that. She's an executive over at Quaker Oats. Give her a hard time.
Well, they make a great cereal, but everybody can't do everything perfect.
No. And so it was renamed Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory because that way it could help promote the chocolate bar better that went out on the shelves. Now, the chocolate bar, as you mentioned, was a bomb. The movie wasn't exactly a huge blockbuster.
No, we got wonderful reviews, but it was distributed. And I don't whine about it now, but it was just distributed badly. The Radio City Music Hall, for instance, wanted to play it, and that was the premier showcase in those days. And for some reason, the head of Paramount decided just to throw it into the local theaters. They didn't give it very much publicity, and it sort of disappeared for about 7 years. Eventually, Warner Brothers bought the movie from Quaker Oats, and they started to put it on television. In fact, our first play was against the Super Bowl, which wasn't the best way to begin. But people saw it, and they wanted to see it again and see it again, and they enjoyed it, and they wanted their kids to see it. And then video cassettes came out.
And people then cable. And can I have you hang on to that thought? Because I want to come back to that. Okay. And I want to open up the phone lines for other people
to
talk with.
Sure, anybody wants.
I think it'll be wonderful. Mel Stewart coming up, the director of the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, for a very limited time, for a special treat Don't you feel like you won a golden ticket? On Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. We want you to be part of this half hour. We've got some callers already getting in on it. We'll shoot you the numbers in just a few minutes so that you can join in our conversation with Mel Stewart, the director of the original movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, based on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Raoul Dahl. And coming up next hour, we'll look forward to exploring more about the London bombing with Howard Bloom. What's in his lens? What's he seeing out of the news that's developing, especially through his perspective of his new book, Reinventing Capitalism, Putting Soul in the Machine, a Radical Reperception of Western Civilization. More on that with Howard next hour. But in the meantime, in the wonderful world of Willy Wonka, there is no terrorism unless one considers the terrorism of Willy Wonka himself, who was a menacing figure in both the book and the movie, but in a way that was just, or at least he never seemed as though he was out to ever really hurt anybody. And that's the interesting tension, I think, from seeing the new movie. And I saw it with my kids yesterday, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Johnny Depp. And I know you haven't seen it yet, Mel Stewart, but as director of the original movie, perhaps you can speak on that a little bit. I always found Gene Wilder's portrayal of Willy Wonka to be a little scary, but he was never creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Johnny Depp presentation is a little creepy.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen Depp. The whole point is when you make a movie, you can't film the book. You have to film a screenplay.
Right.
And contrary to what anybody might say, Raoul Dahl wrote the screenplay. So obviously, he had a great deal to do with what we eventually wound up with. The key change that we made in the book was, in the book, Charlie has a father. In the screenplay, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, there is no father, because both Raoul and I wanted to create a relationship between Gene and Charlie, that Gene finds a son or a son figure, and Charlie finds a father figure. And that is probably the biggest essential change. And Raoul went along with it 100%. So I don't know what he would think of the new version, since he died quite some time ago.
Well, you know what's interesting about it, and I'm not going to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, but there is still that theme that runs through the new movie, but it's actually kind of done in a different way. I guess, though, back to the idea about how Gene Wilder portrayed Willy Wonka. I mean, there are parts when he originally, you know, scared Peter Ostrom, the actor who played Charlie Bucket, by telling him that he had lost everything and he must leave the factory and all that stuff. I mean, he really intimidated me as a kid. And I remember thinking that I didn't like him at all. Get away, you mean, scary Willy Wonka. And then, of course, he turns out to be this wonderful guy. But as I understand it, actually, that was something which Peter Ostrom didn't know. Either the actor hadn't been told exactly what Gene Wilder was going to say to him.
Yeah, well, that's the point. For instance, I never let the children see the chocolate factory when they opened the door. The first time we opened the door, I wanted to get their reaction and to see what the factory looked like, as though it would really happen in real life. The same with the final scene with Gene. It was Gene played it secret as far as Charlie went, so when the scene ran, you've got the exact reaction as which somebody would have, including, for instance, the ride down the river. Nobody knew that Gene was going to go to such crazy lengths and screaming on the first take there. And it was just a surprise. And I think it works. It works for the audience, and it actually worked for the actors.
I like that story about how Gene Wilder said that that he would love to be Willy Wonka if he was allowed to do that little somersault he does at the beginning of the film, where he pretends to trip and then roll down the red carpet.
Yeah, well, that was all part of the general thinking that you mustn't know what Wonka is up to. Everything has to be a surprise. And what could be more of a surprise than seeing the supposed hero of the film come out looking like he was crippled and then do a somersault, a front somersault? I got two German, we did the film in Munich, I got two German stuntmen to have him perfect a front somersault. Just think of standing up right now and falling forward and doing a somersault. Not very easy.
No, not at all. And yet you did have problems finding German Oompa Loompas.
Right. The Oompa Loompas, there's not very many little people in Europe. So we got one from Turkey and one from Malta. I mean, there are a lot of little people in Europe, but not as actors.
Right.
And one came from Malta, Germany. And the chief Oompa Loompa happened to be British, who played Shakespeare. And when I knew he had played in Henry IV, I knew I had my lead Oompa Loompa. And we sort of, by pantomime in different ways, got them all together to do the same thing. They were very cooperative.
Yeah, but they didn't. Only a few of them spoke English, which made it harder, isn't it?
Probably.
It makes it a little harder to direct an Oompa Loompa if he doesn't speak English.
That's right. But we only had money for eight. We didn't want to bring any from the United States. So, but they were so cooperative that we just did stuff by pantomime, and they all got it together.
Well, your daughter, as you mentioned earlier, was the one that brought you Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and said, "Dad, you got to make a movie out of this." Her finder's fee was what, $50?
I gave her a big $50.
Okay. Now, what was there ever a follow-up? Did she ever bring you another movie and say, "Dad, you got to make this one too"?
No, that was the only movie. She went on to become a very successful interior decorator. and it was it's all part of the stories I've tried to include in the book, because pictures are never just simply made. Everything has 100 stories behind it.
Right.
You know, problems and this and that. But this picture was the easiest assignment I ever had, because I think everybody knew it was going to be something very special. And all the kids, Veruca particularly, was to me extraordinary performer.
Well, I love Veruca Salt. I love all of the actresses and actors who played the kids. But of all of them, I heard Mike TV was actually closest to his character, the kid who played the...
Mike in those days was younger than everybody, and he was a little bit of a pain in the neck. But they sort of, because he was younger, they sort of ignored him a little bit, you see, and that might have been his way of getting back into the center of things. You know how kids are.
Yeah,
if somebody's 12 and the next one's 10, he's in a different world.
Well, and everybody's been in Willy Wonka's world at least one time in their life, either from the book or the original movie, or maybe they've already seen this one too. What do you say we open up the phone lines here? We'll take a bunch of callers for Mel Stewart.
After this, I have to get back to my poor family that probably wondered where I went.
I understand that, but you got to talk to
give me some calls.
You got to talk to your fans. We're coming up next for Mel Stewart, the director of the original Willy Wonka, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Time caller line for Mel Stewart, director of Willy Wonka on Coast to Coast AM. Morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Who's this?
Good. This is Ralph from Dayton, Ohio calling.
Ralph, you're talking to Mel Stewart.
Mel, it is such an honor. A little over a year ago, my wife got me for Valentine's Day Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory on DVD and Pure Imagination, your book. I am a huge fan, and thank you so much for just bringing such a great movie to the screen.
I can't hear Mel. I could hear you. Do we have Mel Stewart still?
That's me.
Okay, there. Did you hear his? He was just a fan, and he's telling you how much he enjoyed.
Yes. No, I was here. I heard his speech.
So let me ask you, what about the, you know, a lot of people talked about how that Willy Wonka performance in that first movie was supposed to be too scary for kids. A lot of parents felt like that, but kids never felt that way about the first Willy Wonka.
Well, I don't think, see, I did this picture as an adult picture. I didn't want to do a Disney picture. I didn't want to do a kid picture. It was always an adult picture to me. And I really believe that children, if addressed as adults, will respond like adults. Now, for instance, there's a lot of Shakespeare in the film, a lot of Shakespeare quotes, English poetry. The kids may not get it the first time, but they'll get it the second time, and they'll get it when they're a little bit older, but the adults can enjoy the picture. Now, were they scared on the trip down the river? Many children have told me that, but part of the essence of filmmaking is to scare people every once in a while, as long as it all turns out well in the end, and you know Wonka's got a good heart. And they were scared, many of them, but as they grew older, they realized it was only the magic of films, and they got over it.
Is our caller still there from Dayton?
Yes, I am. I just wanted to ask Mel if I remember when in your book that originally Roald, first of all, what was it like to work with Roald? And the second thing was, I understand that he wasn't totally sold on Gene Wilder. How did you eventually convince him?
No, that's one of those rumors that's nonsense about he wanted Spike Milligan and Spike Milligan came and the blah, blah. Never happened. I never knew he wanted Spike Milligan. Spike Milligan never auditioned. To the best of my knowledge, he had no trouble with Gene. I've got pictures of him and Gene together. The first person we thought about casting was Fred Astaire. He was too old. And we thought about Joel Grey, but he was too small, although a good actor. And Gene walked in one day and sat down, and 2 minutes after he came in, I knew he was Willy Wonka. Nobody could ever play Willy Wonka like Gene Wilder, and we cast him right there. No, that wasn't a problem. You must understand, everyone, when a picture is made, I don't know if there's any writer alive that's happy with the final result, because it always has to be changed in some way or another. But most of the changes were made with Roald knew what we were doing. He wasn't out of the. He came to the set, and I just can't explain it. He was a tough, a tough writer, and but you always have that in our business. Everything, you know, everybody doesn't get everything they want. I personally didn't want songs in the film when we started. But it turned out the songs worked out very well, as far as I'm concerned. I thought Anthony Newley wrote Oompa Limpa song,
right.
Pure Imagination. I thought it was all good, but it wasn't my idea. But what you do is you worry about the whole total picture. You don't worry about ego.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, certainly The Candyman is a song which,
yeah.
You know, who probably most people know that song don't even remember necessarily that it came out of Willy Wonka. It's become such a an iconic tune on its own. The Oompa Loompas, by the way, in the new movie are very interesting because it's all computer generated and it's all the same actor playing all of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different take on the Oompa Loompas, but I'll be curious eventually what you think of it when you see the movie. Let's go east of the Rockies for Ed, a big fan for Mel Stewart, director of the original Willy Wonka. Ed?
Yeah, this is Ed from Warren, Ohio.
Okay, Ed.
Mr. Stewart, I just wanted to say that your movie's probably one of the greatest movies I've ever seen, and I just wanted to know what it was like to work with Gene Wilder and how you got the idea for The Wondrous Boat Ride.
The Wondrous Boat Ride was in the book, but we wanted to make it really scary, so I shot a whole bunch of images like chickens being beheaded or a man who has this caterpillar a centipede crossing his face. But that was all put together in little pieces. Working with Gene was always surprising. He would always come up with something, and then it would come out of both of us. For instance, when they're about to enter the factory, Gene and I looked at each other, how can we make it different? Well, let's talk in German suddenly. So we wrote a scene in German, no sense to it at all, but it makes the audience and the people in the picture wonder what the hell is going on here. Why are they talking in German? Well, that's all part of that that throwing you off kilter, so you don't know quite what's coming. And that's what keeps children, when they look at the movie, they just think it's not going to be exactly the way you think it's going to be.
Well,
and that's the whole point of the movie.
And thank you, Ed, too. The first caller mentioned the DVD, the limited edition DVD that's out, and that includes a making of Willy Wonka, the original Willy Wonka. And it has these fascinating stories in it. I have to share this one that just really caught me, and I keep thinking about it, because the writer that polished the script of Raoul Dahl in of the original Willy Wonka movie, David Seltzer, who goes on to write The Omen, tells this story. And I want to hear it from your perspective. He talks about how it's the end of a very long shoot, right? 16-hour days. He's been on the set forever, and they're just wrapping up the film, and he figures everything's in the can. I can go. And he goes to this little fishing cabin in Maine.
I'll tell you that story. We did bring in somebody to polish the script, and his name was David Seltzer, and he was a young kid that worked for me, 23 years old or something, and he had been a text researcher, but I felt he had it. And I hired him, and he went to Munich, and we had him rewrite. Just polish, you know, just give a little American look at the thing. And at the end, we were shooting on the last day, and in the original script, the last line of the picture was yippee. And I said, oh, no, we can't end the picture with yippee.
Yippee.
Where is that kid that came in to polish? Oh, he's back in Maine. He's so tired from all the work. He's just taking a rest. I said, well, I don't care where he is. I've got Gene Wilder on the set, and all the people are running around, and it's costing us a fortune, but I need a line to end the show. And I called Maine, and he was in a group of six cabins with one phone on a tree. And whoever came by would pick up the phone and tell the other people. So I call Maine and the phone on the tree, and I say, who is this? And he says, I think I know who is calling me. I said, is this David? I said, yes, it's David. I said, David, I need the last line of the show. He says, well, I'll think about it. You want me to write a line for the end of the show? I'll think about it, and I'll call you back or so forth. I said, no, David, you don't understand. We're on the set. Gene Wilder's here with the rear projection, and all the people are running around. I want it now, like the song goes in the movie. He says, well, how much have I got? I said, you've got 5 minutes. I'm going to wait on the phone, and I want the last line of the picture. Now, everybody in the audience out there now thinks, what would you do? What line would you come up with to end the picture? Because that's where the kid was under the pressure. And about a minute and a half later, I remember I looked at my watch. He comes back. Well, here's the ending. I said, all right, what is it? He says, well, Charlie's just won the factory. So Mr. Wonka says to him sternly, do you know what happens to people that get everything they want in life, Charlie? And Charlie bewildered says, no, Mr. Wonka. He says, they live happily ever after. Now, how that young man, under that pressure,
right,
came up with the line that ends every fairy tale.
Right.
And so I said to him, not too bad, David. All right, you can go back. But he went on. He did a feature for me right after that. One is a Lonely Number. And then he went on to write The Omen. So obviously he had talent, too.
Sure. Well, it's interesting to hear him tell that story from his perspective on a limited edition DVD, because he was expecting you all to just like hang up in disgust. He thought it was a terrible line.
Well, I was a tough guy in those days. I'm not tough anymore. But you know what? When you're on the set, you've got to remember one thing. There's a thing in Shakespeare that says, upon the king, let us our lives, our souls lay on the king. When you're on that set, you're the guy that has to make the decision. You know, nobody else can make it.
Well,
the picture doesn't get made, so you better make up your mind very quickly.
And you made some wonderful decisions on the original Willy Wonka that's out, along with the book Pure Imagination. Mel Stewart, thank you for tearing yourself away from your family.
I know. Well, they're probably lost. I'll never see them again.
Okay.
It's worth being on the show.
You give them a hug for me, and I'll pay you back sometime. God bless you, and have a wonderful night.
Get it on Amazon.com.
We'll send them there. They'll pick it up. Thank you so much, Mel Stewart. And coming up in just a few minutes, Howard Bloom. Next hour, Howard Bloom. Was Osama bin Laden behind the London bombings? And what does Osama really want from us? What could we ever have done to have stopped these bombings? And what about the nuclear danger coming from militant Islam? Howard Bloom next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.